From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the State of the Union, manhunt and shootout in California, and a pope will abdicate for the first time in 600 years. In his State of the Union address, President Obama talked budget, education, immigration, and guns. Gun victims, he said, deserve a vote on gun control.
The families of Oak Creek and Tucson and Blacksburg and the countless other communities ripped open by gun violence, they deserve a simple vote.
In California, a fire, a final shootout with ex-cop accused killer Chris Dorner, then confirmation of Dorner's remains. Here's the gunfire, then LA's ABC 7 News.
Authorities confirm the remains found inside that cabin near Angeles Oaks are those of the accused killer.
And Pope Benedict XVI, at a meeting of cardinals, announced he will step down at the end of the month, the first pope to do so in 600 years.
In order to govern the bark of St. Peter and proclaim the gospel, both strength of mind and body are necessary. Strength which in the last few months has deteriorated in me.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Jerry Seib of The Wall Street Journal, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do you make of the president's address, of Chuck Hagel's troubles, North Korea's nukes, the killer in California? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Molly Ball, staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. Molly Ball, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be here.
And from Washington, Gerald Seib, Washington bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal. Jerry Seib, welcome back to you as well. Great to have you here, Jerry.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Molly, and Jerry.
Let's go right to that vote just coming yesterday, or no vote, I guess, or the vote that didn't happen on Chuck Hagel. Republicans saying, we don't know enough about this and that. Senatorial leader, Majority Leader Harry Reid saying, this is all political. Here he is complaining about the Republicans using essentially a filibuster to stop progress on the Hagel nomination for Secretary of Defense.
Is that something they need to have on their resume? I filibustered one of the president's nominees. Is that what they want? The filibuster of Senator Hagel's confirmation is unprecedented. I repeat, not a single nominee for Secretary of Defense ever in the history of our country has been filibustered. Never, ever.
Jerry Seib, what's going on with this nomination?
Well, the non-vote, or vote, depending on how you look at it, was a bit of political theater. Harry Reid, the Democratic leader, knew going in that there wouldn't be the 60 votes needed to break what is effectively a filibuster. He wanted to put Republicans on the record saying that they wanted to hold up the nomination for a while more. The Republican response was, well, we're not trying to kill the nomination. We want more information about Chuck Hagel, and we want more information from the administration about that raid on Benghazi that has been so controversial. Mm-hmm. And so the outcome was kind of clear to both sides. They went through the motions. Chuck Hagel probably will still be confirmed in a couple of weeks because at that point he will probably only need 51 votes when Republicans relent. But I think he will have been damaged somewhat in the process, and the rancor in the Senate will be higher.
Molly, there was a significant campaign to kill the Hagel nomination even before it was formally made. Is that what's playing out here, dressed up in all kinds of different clothes? Or, I mean, is this really about the kind of details that are being rolled out here? Is it really about Benghazi?
It's about all these things, and it's about Hagel's relationship with a lot of his former Republican colleagues. But I agree with Jerry. It's political theater on the part of the Democrats, and the politics of it are terrible for the Republicans because now they're in this position of saying, this isn't a filibuster. We're not trying to hold up the nomination. But then what did you just do, and what are you trying to do? It's really difficult for them to explain what they're trying to do in terms, any terms other than this sort of politically choreographed sort of show, and especially if they are, as they say, going to come back in about 10 days and allow him to be confirmed, it's not clear what the point of all this has been.
Jerry, I mean, you know, the first objection here was that he was not supportive enough of Israel. Seemed to be one of the very first motivations for people working against Chuck Hagel. Is that still at work here? There's many layers at this point. And are you confident that he will ultimately be nominated as Secretary of Defense?
Well, on the latter point, I do think, and I'm fairly confident he'll ultimately be nominated. Even Republicans who voted not to confirm him yesterday said that. And to be fair to the opposition, there are some serious issues here. One is
he certainly fumbled at his hearing.
Yeah, no, that's true. He did not help his cause in his hearing, where he didn't answer the criticism very effectively, and the criticisms are in fact on important issues. There is level and kind of support for the state of Israel. There is attitude toward Iran and its nuclear program and sanctions that are designed to stop that nuclear program. And there's a big issue that's gotten less attention, but that is really important, which is the level, the size of the U.S. nuclear arsenal, where some people on the Republican side think Chuck Hagel would be willing, and President Obama, by the way, would be willing to take that arsenal down to levels that they think are too low. Those are all really serious issues. So this is not about nothing. I'm just not sure we've resolved any of those issues in the debate.
Jack Beatty, what do you see playing out here in the political theater and in the substantial disagreements beneath, behind, around it?
Well, the political theater reached a pitch of passion this week in the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing when a rare event happened. One senator, actually two senators, told off another. This was a hearing about the vote, preliminary to the vote on Hagel. It was a party-line vote, of course. And Senator Ted Cruz of Texas said, wondered aloud whether, quote, it is at a minimum relevant to know if that $2,000 he deposited, Hagel, in his bank, came directly from Saudi Arabia, came directly from North Korea. This referring to, I think, either money from speeches or
a hedge fund payment.
Or hedge fund, yes, yes. And he was immediately repudiated for that McCarthyite charge by Senator Bill Nelson of Florida, who said, you've impugned the patriotism of the nominee, you've gone over the line. And then John McCain, to his credit, said no one on this committee should derogate the character of Chuck Hagel. That's out of beyond the bounds. It's rare that you see that in the Senate, and good for John McCain for standing up for Hagel, whom he opposes.
Yes, I've got a little of that sound. It was a remarkable moment here. This is the new freshman senator, Ted Cruz, Texas Republican, talking about Chuck Hagel and money from hedge funds. Where did it really come from? Here's Senator Cruz.
It is at a minimum relevant to know if that $200,000 that he deposited in his bank account came directly from Saudi Arabia, came directly from North Korea. Now, I have no evidence to suggest that it is or isn't, but his statement was that he could not even tell this committee that $200,000 did not come directly from a foreign government.
Jerry Seib, what do you make of that? I mean, here's $200,000. Hagel reports it, says who nominally it came from, and then it could have come from North Korea. I have no evidence, but is that McCarthy style or what, Jerry?
Well, the backdrop of this has been kind of a backroom debate about whether Chuck Hagel raised a lot of money from countries that are either unsavory or questionable.
North Korea?
A lot of that, but I'm saying this is how it started. Okay. We ended up with North Korea, but we started with raising money for a group called the Atlantic Council, of which he was the head, which is a think tank. And there was a lot of unhappiness among Republicans. Well, he raised money for that from Saudi Arabia and other Persian Gulf states, and maybe other countries you don't like so much. And then it sort of snowballed through the week, and pretty soon that's where we ended up.
So what do we think the lesson of this is, Molly? I mean, down the road, if someone thinks they may be nominated for secretary of this or that, or defense in particular, can you make criticisms of policy on Iran, on Israel, on down the line without being, afraid that you're going to be dragged through all this? Or is it just don't come if you don't have a squeaky clean resume that, meets your fellow Republicans, perfect pitch in every dimension?
I think this is a special case. We have seen other nominees glide through recently. Just look at John Kerry's nomination for Secretary of State. If you would have told a lot of people in Washington a year ago that Democratic former presidential nominee would sail through to confirmation, yep, while a former Republican senator would be the one that Republicans picked to fight over, I think people might have been surprised. But as Jerry has noted, there are some very specific issues at play here, as well as, you know, some personal dynamics. And, you know, a lot of the debate in the hearing was not actually about these currently relevant sort of policy issues, but was about relitigating the debate over the war in Iraq and the surge. And so I don't think this necessarily poisons the well for every nominee going forward. It does certainly signal that the Republicans are not interested in backing down and compromising in situations where they are not inclined to.
Jack, what do you think is the message down the road here? And do you think Hagel will hang in, or could he still walk away from this?
I think everything about him that I see, he'll hang in. He's an infantryman. He'll hang in, and I think he can, in a way, wear it as a badge of honor. I mean, to be defamed like that, where you know, by a senator.
Honor, maybe, but no fun.
No fun. But he's a tough guy, and I think I don't think this hurts him. You know, I think John McCain, again, in his candor, he is one of the few people who really talks straight. He said on Fox News yesterday, "Look, you just can't underestimate how much his Republican colleagues resent him for turning his collar." I mean, he really did. You know, he
who went against Iran ultimately and more.
Yes, and turned against the Republican Iraq foreign policy on Iraq and called George Bush the worst president since Herbert Hoover. McCain said, "You can't do that and expect any love from us."
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, State of the Union, Pope to go, Hagel trouble, cruise ship trouble, big cop killer drama out in California, and a North Korean nuclear test. Molly Ball is with us from The Atlantic in Washington today. Gerald Saib is here from The Wall Street Journal, Washington Bureau Chief for The Journal, writes the weekly Capital Journal column there. Our own Jack Beatty's here. Here was the president's State of the Union address on Tuesday, building it all around the importance of the health of the middle class.
It is our generation's task, then, to reignite the true engine of America's economic growth, a rising, thriving middle class.
There's the theme at the heart of it, Molly Ball. There's a big agenda attached to that. What about the big thematic President Obama at the podium there and what he's asserting in the face of this divided Congress? How's it look from Washington, Molly?
Set in on a couple of focus groups of voters who were watching the speech because I was interested to know what they would take away from it, what actual people mm-hmm. would think the president was talking about. And it was that broad message about the middle class and about jobs that the people really took away and responded pretty positive to in a few different sort of instant poll reactions. There was less reaction to the stuff about foreign policy and some of the specific issues that he touched on. But in broad terms, people seem to feel good about it. One thing that Pollster found that I thought was really interesting was that in the past, when Obama has talked about these positive signs for the economy and tried to make the case that things are getting better very gradually, people have rejected that. They haven't believed it. They haven't seen it in their own lives. Now, for sort of the first time in a long time, people actually seem to be sharing a little bit of the president's optimism.
Optimism, and yet there's a big perspective being pushed here as well. We did not hear it coming reflected back, certainly. It was opposed in Marco Rubio's response. The president saying we can't just sit here deadlocked forever. Here he was sending, let's end the brinkmanship.
The greatest nation on earth cannot keep conducting its business by drifting from one manufactured crisis to the next. We can't do it.
And his agenda, he said, would not increase our deficit by a single dime.
Tonight I'll lay out additional proposals that are fully paid for and fully consistent with the budget framework both parties agreed to just 18 months ago. Let me repeat. Nothing I'm proposing tonight should increase our deficit by a single dime.
Jerry Saab, what's the perspective, the big vision you heard from the president in the details of this agenda, and how do you see it hitting the Congress sitting in front of him?
Well, look, this was the opposite of the inaugural address, in which he talked about things that, other than the economy and jobs, this was very much a speech about the economy and jobs and, as you said, the middle class. And he rolled out things that sounded like activist government, infrastructure spending, changing education programs, using government programs to spur on manufacturing, raising the minimum wage. But if you look behind those words, you actually see something that the president, I think, was referring to there, which is that there's not a lot of money for those things. This was not a big spending program that he rolled out. The infrastructure money was repurposed money he's asked for and failed to get before. The education money, some of that for preschool, would come from states, not from the federal government. The minimum wage, obviously, would be paid for not by government but by businesses. And so I thought this was a speech that showed what it looks what you see when you see an activist president who's on a diet. I mean, this was an activist government speech, but not a big spending speech. And Republicans didn't really buy that notion, but I think if you look at the reality, that's what you get here.
Jack, where does this leave us? I mean, we had the election. In a way, this is the president carrying on his middle-class primary theme of his election campaign. Now we're back to a divided Congress, President Obama in the White House, and the old sort of, how old now, divide between, you know, are we going to go toward cut, or get the government involved more, get it more active, and celebrate that when it works? Where does it leave us, Jack? Are we in the same deadlock?
I think we are, and I think the president is sort of putting something on the board. He's saying to the electorate, and by the way, he's doing this more and more. He's going out and talking to people behind the Congress. He's saying, I think, send me a different House. It's probably very unlikely, but send me people who would vote for these sensible measures. I say sensible because, you know, things like the minimum wage, two-thirds of the public, the last poll I saw, support a $10 an hour minimum wage. There's more than majority support, nearly unanimous support for elements of gun control. There's wide support for immigration reform. And I suspect that as people find out about universal preschool, that will become popular, too. So he's saying, here are things that you want. The polls show people want. What's stopping it is this Republican House. We have an election coming up in 2 years. Give us some more people. Send some Democrats here, and we can get this done.
The Republicans, of course, answered right back, first in Spanish from Marco Rubio, who may well be on a ticket in 2016. Here's Senator Rubio, Florida.
Entonces, señor presidente, no me opongo a sus planes porque quiero proteger a los ricos.
Saying, Mr. President, I don't suppose oppose your plans because I want to protect the rich. I oppose your plans because I want to protect my neighbors. And then here's Rubio explaining his vision, a Republican vision, of what makes the middle class grow.
This opportunity to make it to the middle class or beyond, no matter where you start out in life, it isn't bestowed on us from Washington. It comes from a vibrant free economy where people can risk their own money to open a business. And when they succeed, they hire more people who in turn invest or spend their money they make helping others start a business and create jobs.
There's the Republican vision. It sounds Romney-esque, but maybe not the Spanish part. Let's hear from our listeners. Austin, Texas. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi there. I watched the State of the Union the other night, and then I also watched the Marco Rubio response afterward.
Yeah.
And I must say that it was completely disconnected from what was said by the president in the State of the Union. Instead, the Republicans were responding by saying, did you hear what he said? It was big government. It was more spending. That's his answer to everything. Well, I did listen to what the president said. He didn't talk about bigger government. He did not talk about more spending. As a matter of fact, you just played a clip where he said everything is paid for. I think the Republicans were trying to put words in his mouth maybe ahead of the speech. The problem is it came out flat. And this is the Republican Party that's trying to say, we're a kinder, gentler, we understand, we're going to reach across the aisle and try to be friends. I watched that State of the Union. The Republicans looked like zombies. I mean, Joe Wilson famously a couple years ago said, you lie. That group actually stood up and applauded every once in a while. The one I saw this week, they didn't even look like they wanted to be in the room.
Aaron, I appreciate your call, Molly Ball, but, you know, the president says it won't cost a dime more. That could be disputed. He certainly says smarter government, not bigger government. But he is pushing a line that Republicans have pushed against for a long time now, in rhetoric at least, that they just want less government and they want smaller deficits. They want not, you know, an extra dime, but many fewer dimes spent.
Yeah, well, the Republicans are in a tough place right now. I don't think I'm the first to say that by a long shot. They're having trouble articulating an agenda that wins over majority support. As Jack was just saying, there's widespread public support for a lot of things the president is advocating. Ever since the election, the president has really felt a sort of political wind at his back, and he's been pushing this perceived advantage. Now, Republicans grouse about, oh, he's going to overreach, he's overplaying his hand. But I also hear some real fear from the Republicans that I talked to on Capitol Hill that this is going to be a successful strategy where Obama can just blame them for everything and sort of and push these popular policies and put them in this really tough spot.
So, Jerry, in terms of rubber meeting the road, is that a recipe for meeting halfway? If they may not philosophically like it, but they're threatened with real electoral problems if they oppose it, might we get some compromised versions of what the president's putting on the table?
Well, I think we might. You know, there were two areas that hadn't gotten as much attention in the president's speech that really do represent areas where there can be agreement. One was immigration reform. Republicans have swung around behind that in a big way, and Marco Rubio talked about that a fair amount. And free trade agreements. You know, the president talked about something you didn't see him stress a whole lot in his first term, free trade agreements, big ones in this case, with Asia and East Asian countries and with Europe. That's something Republicans can get behind. And if that happens, it's a pretty big deal. So, and thirdly, Tom, I think one of the things that's happening in Washington right now is you can kind of feel the air going out of the great budget spending debates. I mean, Republicans have sort of gotten tired of it. Democrats have long since been tired of it. And I think we're heading toward, if we can get past the disputes just ahead, a period in which there's going to be more of an agreement to disagree. And I think Republicans increasingly will try to win the debate, knowing they can't win the legislative battles. And I think that will probably move us all to a slightly different and a little less frenetic place.
I mean, the air may be going out of that, but we're going to have a lot of fury over sequestration right in front of us here. Is the air going out because somehow it's now clear that the debt is benign? Or is it still a big problem and we just don't want to take it on? Or it's the wrong approach for the economic moment?
I think a couple of things. One is an acknowledgement that everybody agrees the debt is a big problem, but the how big a problem and what you do about it are just simply areas where there's no agreement between the two parties in Washington right now, and probably won't be. You know, there is a flashpoint coming on the sequester, these big automatic across-the-board cuts that have to happen on March 1st unless there's a better plan come up with, and an end to government funding entirely at the end of March unless Congress comes up with a new budget. Those are going to be difficult times. I have this feeling once we get past those and some unsatisfactory compromise will be put together, that maybe that people will decide to move on and agree that there is just no consensus on the big issues. And we'll have the debate, but not the endless battles.
Interesting. Don in Shopville, Kentucky. Don, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Back to the State of the Union, the line that stuck out to me was the president said that we can't make promises we can't keep, but we must keep the promises we've made.
Yes.
And then maybe two, three paragraphs down, universal pre-K comes into the conversation, which I know he said it would be revenue neutral and all these. I don't understand that. Like, I don't understand how that can work.
Because it sounds like a new promise to you, you mean? New expenditure or what?
Of course. It's brand new. Mm-hmm. Brand new promise. It's, I don't understand how that can work. And then to Mr. Beatty's comments earlier about the public opinion in the country right now, you know, we don't govern on public or on opinion polls. If I could make that count.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess at the end we're supposed to govern on votes. Opinion polls may be related to them, but I know what you mean. There's a difference between opinion polls and possibly and what will actually work. Thank you, Don, for that. Jack, you know, there's Don. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting comment, the line in the president's speech, you know, and I'll mangle it here, but, you know, don't make promises we can't keep, but keep the promises we've made, raises the question of whether we can keep the promises entirely on Medicare, Social Security, and more. And then Don says, you know, next breath, he's promising something new. How do you pay for that?
Yes, Roy Blunt, a Republican senator from Missouri, said, you know, we can't even deal with the things we have here, and now he's making new promises for the future. But, you know, you have to, I guess, balance things, and he can't just sit there and do nothing. This would cost, I have seen, estimates of $10 billion in federal spending a year. It could even cost more. That's not
pre-K?
That's not chump change. But we have to look at it in terms of history. Yesterday, Gail Collins had a wonderful column. In 1971, Walter Mondale sponsored a bill that would have effectively done this. Universal pre-K got a huge majority in the Senate, 63 votes, vetoed by President Nixon, partly at the advice of Pat Buchanan, who was around then. And she goes on to talk about why this is important. She says, we have no bigger crisis as a nation than the class barrier. We're near the bottom of the industrial world when it comes to mobility. A child born to poor parents has a pathetic chance of growing up to be anything but poor. This isn't the way things were supposed to be here, but here we are. That is the truth. And this program would marginally make, we have David Brooks today, the conservative columnist, saying, looking at very skeptically at whether it could work and saying, well, maybe it could work. Maybe it really could make a difference to children who are just trapped on the lower rungs of our society.
The president saying, let's do something about these problems. Let's go to Laura in Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah.
Well, concerning the pre-K, I've got two children that are now almost in high school, and okay. I think pre-K, universal pre-K, is essential. And we have that here in Des Moines or in Iowa, and I think it's something that our Republican governor and the Democratic Senate and or you know state legislature have been able to come to agreement on. What I was really going to say, though, was about this carnival ship stuck out in the ocean for 5 days.
Terrible.
With no water. I mean, it's, can you imagine?
Stinky.
And it's kind of like a metaphor. If we don't take care of our infrastructure, our roads, our waterways, our children, that's how we're going to be. We're going to be stuck, just like those people.
Laura, we've got it loud and clear. I mean, Molly, what do you think? Is the president's kind of making an appeal to let's break out of the grimness here, of the endless grim debate, and let's do some things that we can afford, he says, to make the country better. Is it a moment when that can sail, or do the numbers come right back in and smack that perspective down?
Well, I think that's what we're going to find out. You know, the president is making a forceful case for a government that is more active in people's lives and that does more things for more people, and that does cost money. And he's proposing in part that we raise some people's taxes to pay for it. And the question is how that is going to play out in the sequester debate, in the budget debate, and then for the next several years of Obama's final term. Is there going to be some compromise from the other side of the aisle, recognizing that there are things that people want from their government, and that this message that they've been articulating that is all about austerity is maybe not being universally well received? Or are we going to see just this continued gridlock? I don't think we know that at this point.
Jerry, if the air's going out of the big budget debate, and of course we've got a month or more of it right in front of us probably, but what is the main Republican poll to hold on to if that's not at the heart of it?
Well, I think it's still at the heart of it. I'm distinguishing between continuing to make the point and thinking that you can, because you control the House of Representatives but nothing else in Washington, change the outcomes here. So I think the debate goes on. And by the way, there's a broader thing going on in the background here that's true for both parties and that everybody needs to get their brain around, which is that the budget realities, and this is true whether you have a Democratic or a Republican president, is that the things the government simply has to spend money on, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, interest on the debt, things that can't be avoided are squeezing out everything else. And so when you look at why there isn't more money for infrastructure or why we have to argue so much about spending money on roads and bridges, why can't we just go ahead and spend it? It's because the part of the budget that is left over for those sorts of things is shrinking, has shrunk a lot over the last 15 years, and it's going to keep shrinking, and that's a problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, the Carnival cruise ship Triumph, stranded and disabled in the Caribbean for 5 days, now back in port. Passengers cheered, and Kendall Jenkins, who was on board the Triumph, spoke to reporters.
I'm speechless. It's just really great to finally be back in America and on land. I'm not angry. I'm just so happy to be home, really.
And off that boat, Blade Runner Oscar Pistorius, the South African Olympic track star who won on carbon fiber legs, charged with murdering his girlfriend. Here's the police announcement in Pretoria.
At this stage, we can confirm that a young woman, a 30-year-old woman, did die on the scene of gunshot wounds. A 26-year-old man has been arrested and has been charged with murder.
That man, Oscar Pistorius. And Banana Joe, a little monkey-faced black dog and affin-pincher, won Best in Show at Westminster.
Best in Show winner for the 137th Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show is the affin-pincher.
Banana Joe!
Banana Joe. We're looking at a week in the news. State of the Union, Pope to go, Hegel trouble, cruise ship trouble. Cop killer drama in California, that North Korean nuclear test. I want to ask about this with our panel this week. Yet another nuclear test out of North Korea. Thousands gathered in the capital Pyongyang, mass rally after that test on Tuesday. Jerry Seib, I don't know how plugged in you are to this, but where are we headed here? I mean, you know, three now, and North Korea is saying this one is a miniaturized, lighter nuclear device with greater explosive force. They seem to quite all but very explicitly be saying, you know, we're getting closer to something we can send your way, USA. Or is that overreacting, Jerry?
Well, we're headed in a bad direction. I don't know that the fact that they conducted this test tells you we're headed in that bad direction at a much faster rate than we already knew we were. And I think the real mystery is what the country's new leader is trying to do here. Is he trying to establish, as you say, a nuclear arsenal that is can be a force of intimidation with the rest of the world? Or is he simply trying to shore up his own credentials internally with the army and with his uncles who are looking over his shoulder to make sure he's sufficiently tough before he tacks off in a different, new, and potentially, you know, more accommodating direction? You have to know more about the North Korean government than any of us do to have a reasonable guess about the answer to that question.
But are you hearing in Washington, I mean, is there a point at which this becomes not tolerable in terms of American security? And what happens then? I mean, South Korea's right across the border. There's Japan right next door. I don't know how you would deal with this.
Well, the key capital to watch on that question is not Washington. Mm-hmm. It's Beijing. Mm-hmm. It is. And the response from the Chinese government in this case was pretty interesting. It was less apologetic for the North Korean regime than it has been in the past. That's what got people's attention in Washington. When the lights get turned off because the Chinese stop sending the fuel for North Korea, that's when things would really change. We're not at that point yet, but there's a new government coming into power in China. We'll see what their attitude is. And that's where the fate of this drama, I think, will be determined more than any place else.
Plenty of Pentagon warnings this week that budget cuts that would come with sequestration would really hurt American military readiness. Here is General James Amos, Commandant of the Marine Corps, testifying before the House Armed Services Committee on Wednesday.
There should be no misunderstanding. The combined effects of continuing resolution and sequestration will have a deleterious effect on the stability of global order, the perceptions of our enemies, and the confidence of our allies. Sequestration, viewed solely as a budget issue, would be a grave mistake, bordering irresponsibility.
And of course, it's not just the military that would be cut. Molly Ball, do we appear to be on a path toward sequestration actually kicking in? New proposals being floated by Democrats in the last couple of days. Is there a way off this train track?
My sources tell me sequestration is almost definitely going to happen. Right now, there are no talks. There is nobody negotiating. The Democrats are putting together their own proposal that Republicans view as unilateral and therefore unacceptable and in part also unacceptable because it raises taxes. This is a very confusing debate because the partisan divide is not at all clear. You have some Democrats saying, let's go ahead and cut the Pentagon, but then being worried about some of the domestic side spending cuts. You have some Republicans say, well, we want to cut spending. This is a clumsy way to do it, but we'll take what we can get because spending cuts are important. And then others, more the sort of defense hawk type, saying, no, this is absolutely unacceptable. We can't allow defense to be cut. So really, lawmakers, policymakers are all over the map, and there hasn't been any effort that I can see to actually sit down at a table at the table and hammer any of this out.
Jack, that hearing on sequestration and its military impact, very interesting this week. Wolf at the door, said a Deputy Defense Secretary, Ash Carter. General Odierno, of course, of Iraq fame, says, I began my career in a hollow army. I don't want to end my career in a hollow army. Of course, it's not as though we don't spend a lot. But here was your Senator McCain saying it's Orwellian. Funny choice of words maybe here, but he's to be on the verge of sequestration even as North Korea conducts nuclear tests and concerns grow about stability in Iran and Egypt. McCain saying, Jack, the signal we're sending to Iranians is don't worry, the aircraft carrier is not coming.
Oh, God. Yeah, you know, I think the assumption behind this was that Republican barons would simply say, we cannot cut that defense budget, and therefore we're going to have to, you know, make a new settlement rather than the sequestration. But they've been outvoted. I mean, the Tea Party people want the cuts. And if you look at the blogs, you know, the president has rightly said that since the Budget Act of 2011, about $1 trillion in spending has been cut. But that's not believed on the right. They laugh at that, and they simply don't accept that there has been any. And in fact, the deficit is coming down next year. But all of that is not that's not registering. They want real cuts. They see a chance to get them, and they also have a talking point. And the talking point is it was the president's idea. Well, you're going to hear that a lot. Our listeners will. Justin Amash, who's a Republican from Michigan, said, "I think it's a mistake to talk like that. It's totally disingenuous. The debt ceiling deal was agreed to by Democrats and Republicans, and regardless of who came up with it, they all voted for it. So you can't vote for something and with a straight face go and blame the other guy for its existence in law, and yet that's what they're doing continually. It's the president's idea. It's the president. They voted for it.
Yeah, on the other hand, that Harry Reid observation, you know, you think you're as low as you can go, and then you go lower. I mean, I very well remember everybody thinking there's no way anybody will ever allow this to come into effect.
Yes.
And here we are, Molly Ball saying it looks like it's on the rails. Nick in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Nick, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
The biggest frustration I have about any of this, I have a sole proprietor small business. And I talk to a lot of people during the day, and even during the elections, the biggest thing that I hear from everybody is that we're choosing the best of two evils. That when you know, you hear Democrats, Republicans, and they're blaming each other back and forth, the pure fact is that I find a lot of people that I talk to just aren't happy with the way government is run. They feel that the people in charge are, you know, out of touch with general Americans, and I'm in the same boat. I just feel like we're kind of just choosing what the people want us to choose.
But not good. What's the way out of that, Nick? What's the way out of that?
You know, the hard point is, though, the hardness is, I think the way out is going to be a big change. And I think it also is something that's going to take many years to do. Everybody's trying to say, you know, let's do what we can in 4 years with the president. I don't care who we're talking about, Republican or Democrat. But none of this stuff can be done in 4 years or 8 years. We're looking at a plan that likely is going to take 20 years to fix.
Yeah, I agree with you there. We've got big issues, and the president's saying, let's get going here. Republicans don't like the direction he wants to get going in. But if we're just deadlocked, maybe that's how a great nation gets in trouble. I appreciate your call, Nick. Chris in Nashville. Chris, you're on.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you see, Chris?
I just wanted to bring up the point with Oscar Pistorius and what I was sharing with my daughter yesterday in regards to the tragedy that has kind of unfolded. And everything around that whole scene it's basically a tragedy to see that. And then we are dealing with the concern, the issue in California, and then this young girl in Chicago that was killed very close to where she lived. And it brings up the whole concept of our gun control. And so I have a real concern with that. It's such a tragedy to see somebody like Oscar Pistorius, who we watched in the Olympics.
Yeah, so heroic there.
Yes, very, very heroic. A role model, a advocate, an example for youth that are going through physical challenges, and he was that. So I'm sad to see that, because I thought that just kind of has pushed everything in regards to gun control just up to the forefront.
Yeah, bullets flying all over the place, and it's not fun to see. And apparently there are 4 bullets shot through the bathroom door in his home, and of course the model, his girlfriend dead there, he's charged with murder, breaking down in tears in the courtroom. And you're very right, of course, Chris, that's not the only place we had bullets flying. President Obama in Chicago today talking about just one of the many murders there. That whole scene in California with ex-cop Chris Dorner in the cabin on fire, bullets flying everywhere. Here's San Bernardino Sheriff John McMahon talking with the press on Wednesday about that firefight at the cabin on Tuesday.
There were rounds being fired, as you saw in some of the news coverage. It was absolutely incredible. It was like a war zone. And our deputies continued to go in to that area and try to neutralize and stop the threat.
Well, eventually they did. He was an ex-policeman with a lot of arms and arms training. Molly, what about the gun control elements of the proposals that are floating on Capitol Hill? Do they have traction or not in this State of the Union week?
There does seem to be a little bit of traction for the most popular proposals, in particular the expansion of background checks. The assault weapon ban is almost definitely not going to happen, but that wouldn't have as big of an impact when you look at what the causes of gun crime are in this country. Only about 5% of the gun deaths come from rifles of any kind, including the so-called assault weapons. And so the gun control advocates that I've spoken to are much more hopeful about the background check provision actually being an effective way to curb some of this epidemic of gun violence that we see.
Jerry, the peak of the president's address the other night, you know, was calling about gun victims and let's at least have a vote. But with that, he almost sounded as though he was saying that's all we can get is a vote. I mean, how much do you think he can actually get?
Well, I totally agree with Molly. I think that the lines are becoming more clear here, that there is probably a consensus emerging to do more on background checks, to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them to the extent that's possible, but that there probably will not be an assault weapons ban. And I think what the president was saying was, let's have votes so that we can get the most that's possible, as opposed to just throwing in the towel and concluding we can't get everything. And, you know, he'll be somewhat successful in that. There probably will be votes. People who don't want an assault weapon ban are not afraid to vote against it, so I don't think they would object to having a vote on something like that. And I think we'll come out of this with some modest changes to gun laws in this country, but not dramatic ones.
Karen's calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling about the LAPD incident with Christopher Dorner. And disclosure, I was formerly an arbitrator, a civilian arbitrator on LAPD Boards of Rights, the adjudicating body that dismissed officers. And what I would say is that I hope that LAPD, and for that matter all police departments, will do major soul searching on what happened to this young man.
What are you suggesting, or what are you concerned about?
Well, what I'm concerned about is that, you know, LAPD is no slouch organization. And they hired a young man who was an officer, and they adjudicated, they decided that he could be an officer. And then at some point, he had a breakdown of some sorts. I mean, people can be very angry after a Board of Rights. In my day, they weren't fair. They were terribly unfair.
I mean, he said that he witnessed things that were wrong. He reported them and then got, you know, railroaded out as a whistleblower.
Well, I can't speak to that because I don't know the details of his case, but that did happen in the past. When I was on in the 90s after the Rodney King incident, one of my colleagues walked off saying, this is a kangaroo court and I can't stay. I preferred to stay and dissent if I had to and try to change it internally. But when Chief Bratton came on, and a colleague of mine, George Gascon, who's now the Attorney General in San Francisco, I helped him with this work to reform the Boards of Rights. I can't tell you if I were sitting there, I would have thought he had a fair board. I don't even know what he was accused of, and By the way, they use criminal terminology, even though it's a civilian proceeding. But
yeah, Karen, our time is short here, but so forgive me, but I want to have a moment to pick this up because it is interesting. I mean, way too many dead and a whole region terrorized, and there's nothing to be taken lightly about that at all. On the other hand, Jack, you know, you keep scratching your head when he's complaining, as all this happens, that there was some miscarriage of justice here at the beginning of it. How do you weigh these things? A man clearly going way too far, but we don't know what happened at the beginning of this.
We don't, and the Los Angeles police are going to reopen that hearing, that investigation, and look at it again. Now, whether that would be fair or not, I don't know. So we just don't know. I mean, it just looks as if whatever the complexities of that, this man was just overnight, his world ended. He was deprived of his entire function in life, his mm-hmm. role. He lost his commission in the Navy retroactively. And suddenly, you know, you read these profiles of mass killers, and that's what they say. When there's some irreparable wound to self-esteem, that's when you get these people snap, and it seems to have happened here.
And in this case, up came the gun. I don't want to end without at least a word on the Pope, Jack. It's kind of interesting that, I mean, you know, he says, I just don't have what it takes to do this job anymore. There's a refreshing candor in that. On the other hand, the fact that it has not ever happened in so many centuries. This is something, well, not entirely new, but certainly new in a long, long time, Jack.
It sure is. And, you know, just reading about the problems he's faced, he's had a lot to abdicate about. I mean, my gosh, there's been financial scandals within the Vatican, the big sex scandals outside the Vatican, the change in, communicants all over the world. He's just been overwhelmed by the challenges.
A big change coming to a big institution as the Pope at the end of this month says goodbye to that role, first time in 600 years. Molly Ball with The Atlantic, it's been so good to have you today, Molly, and we're grateful to you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Jerry Seib, always love your insights. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Gerald Seib of the Wall Street Journal. And Jack, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.